Trojan fans, it's time for another installment of the Trojan Blast Recruiting Podcast. We give you the inside scoop on everything about USC football recruiting from the experts who know what they're talking about. Which players have an offer, which ones don't, who the coaches like, and who our experts like. And now, here are your co-hosts for the Trojan Blast Recruiting Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher Ryan Abraham and USCFootball.com national recruiting analyst Gerard Martinez.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Thursday. We're going to talk some USC football recruiting. Yes, it's homecoming week. USC's playing Oregon this weekend. But Gerard, we've been doing as part of our 20th anniversary extravaganza celebrating this year, USCFootball.com's 20th anniversary covering the USC Trojans. Gerard did a couple of great pieces talking about some amazing moments over the last 20 years in USC recruiting. Long pieces, but check them both out on USCFootball.com. We wanted to talk to him about that and have him answer some of your USC recruiting questions. If you have questions for us, email us podcast@USCFootball.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 641-715-3900, extension 816-646. Or go to our website, peristylepodcast.com. Lots of contact information there. We're on iTunes, itunes.com/peristylepodcast. Stitcher Radio, Audio Boom, all different places you can download the podcast. TuneIn Radio, just go there. If you don't see us anywhere, just email me, podcast@usufootball.com. We'll make sure we get it there. But we're all over the place. The Peristyle Podcast. Been doing this for a while now. Hope you guys enjoy the show. Tell your friends about it if they're USC fans. And you want to tell your friends about our guest, Gerard Martinez. No one knows more about USC football recruiting than GMART Live. Follow him on Twitter @GMARTLive. What is up, Gerard? How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I'm recovering from that long piece on 20 years of USC football recruiting. It was a manifesto of sorts.
It was. If you think Gerard's a little verbose when he's talking on the podcast, you should definitely check out this piece. But I thought it was really well done, Gerard, both of them. And you had to make it too because there were just so many great moments. And for recruiting, it's a little different than what, you know, Dan Weber did a great piece on the top 20 memorable moments for the football team. And if you mention 4th and 9, you don't have to say a whole lot. People know what you're talking about. But if you mention Sean Cody, then they might be like, huh, what's the story behind that? So you kind of had to go in a little more detail than maybe if you're talking about the team that things would be, people would be more familiar with.
Exactly. We really had to provide some context for how the team was at that point, sort of behind the scenes, what recruiting was at that point behind the scenes, you know, where USC was as a program in order to sort of establish, you know, why this was impactful. For us, it was not the best or top moments in terms of recruiting. That would have been easy and sort of, you know, obviously a little bit of subjective on my account and sort of things that I liked. And I didn't want to make it about me. There was a lot of sort of personal stories that I could share and say, wow, you know, I was doing this at this particular time. And it was crazy because, you know, when Michael Morgan committed to USC, we were just completely taken off guard. And I was just, I think I was writing a Dylan Baxter piece or something like that. And I was in the middle of that, and somebody from Rivals had called me, and I think it was our Texas A&M guy at the time when we were with Rivals, and says, hey, bro, Mike Morgan to USC. And I go, yeah, okay. And he's like, no, really, he just committed on Fox right now. He just committed on television. And I'm like, dude, really, like, I'm in the middle of this story. Like, I do not need to get pulled off of it for some joke, right? And I just, because Mike Morgan at that point had more or less publicly said that he was down to Texas A&M and Florida State. So for me personally, that was like, wow, this is what was going on, and this is why it's sort of a memorable moment. But I wanted to make it more about what was an impact for USC football program and the casual USC fan. You know, these things that, whether they know it or not, actually impacted the program so much that it ended up impacting that casual fan, the filthy casual fan, as the gamers say. You know, he's a filthy casual. He's not a hardcore fan. Well, there's a lot of fans out there that are not on USCFootball.com, and they're not following the Peristyle daily and getting these stories. So, you know, when you talk about Sean Cody and you talk about behind the scenes and how close he was to going to Notre Dame and how his dad was a Notre Dame guy, and he really sort of became the cornerstone, the turning point in recruiting for USC. He was the first really big name local player that USC was able to lock down. And obviously being a defensive lineman, he helped a lot on the field just with his production. But, you know, I think it was just as much and just as important behind the scenes in terms of the reputation and him being a big-time recruit and other recruits seeing him go to USC and thinking, wow, maybe something has changed about USC. So he kind of started off this, 20 memorable moments, 20 memorable storylines, and it kind of goes, it's a roller coaster ride. I think each, you know, entry, some of our great news and positive things that USC fans remember, the push for Bush, which is kind of, you know, a play on, you know, the Bush push against Notre Dame, but the push for Bush to get him signed and get him away from Notre Dame as a recruit, get him away from Stanford and UCLA, and we talk about that kind of in depth, how USC at that point, Pete Carroll really was convinced that he was going to be a receiver coming out of high school and really kind of recruited him in the beginning as a receiver, and it was Kenny Palomalu, the running backs coach, that was recruiting San Diego at the time and obviously was Reggie Bush's position coach and kind of lobbying to say, hey, you know, we need to recruit this kid as a running back. He wants to play running back. We need to recruit him as a running back. And so, you know, there's a lot of stories like that that are positive, but then we also kind of delved into some of those negative, the ones that USC fans remember and go, oh, God, I wish that didn't happen, Manti Te'o, DeSean Jackson, because that really, those are memorable. With recruiting, it's not just all the stories you remember, like the team that are the great stories that, you know, they win and they got a national championship out of it or somebody broke a record here or there. It's just sort of the soap opera of it all, and soap operas have up and downs, and that's what recruiting is.
Yeah, that's what's great about the piece is there's the Mike Morgan stories, like, wow, never expected him, or Joe McKnight and things like that, where a guy's like, that's amazing that USC got that guy. And then, like, the DeSean Jackson stuff, where you think he's going to USC. And it was funny, I was down at I think it was covering the Senior Bowl back in like 2008 or 2009 or something. It's like John David Booty and a bunch. There was like 7 or 8 USC guys in the Senior Bowl down in Mobile, Alabama. And this was the time like Ed Orgeron was like between jobs. And I was talking to him and, you know, I went to like, you know, introduce myself again. He's like, Ryan, I know who you are. You know, he was great. You know, he just remembers everybody. And I'll never forget DeSean Jackson's family walking by on the other side of this hedge. And they just start gushing over Coach O, Coach. And they were just, they loved him so much, you know, and the kind of impact he had on recruiting. And so when you kind of get behind the scenes a little bit and you see like guys' personalities and that's why someone was going to go to a school or not. Like they just, you know, gravitate towards people. And Ed Orgeron was one of those guys.
There's a lot of personalities and I kind of forgot how much Kenny Norton recruited for USC and the guys that he got. I mean, he was in charge of Joe McKnight, getting Joe McKnight, Mike Morgan as well. I think he was the only guy on the staff at that time that thought they had a good shot at Mike Morgan. I think the rest of the staff was sort of like me and kind of were like, yeah, Mike Morgan's out there. He's a guy, but probably not going to USC. USC was never really his front runner. And Ken Norton had talked to Mike Morgan's brother. I think I got a text message from her or something right before the announcement and saying, fight on, coach, or something like that. And so that was, I think, the first time everybody was like, whoa, this is like, you know, he's actually maybe going to commit to USC here. And everybody else was kind of taken by surprise. But there's a lot of personalities, you know, for USC recruiting over the years. You talk about Ed Orgeron. Obviously, he's a huge personality. He's kind of a centerpiece in that Sean Cody entry with, you know, just how relentless he was after Cody. I mean, the story goes, and Greg Biggins and I both talked about it because we weren't really sure how true the story was, but as legend has it, Ed Orgeron showed up to one of Sean Cody's games. I think it was a playoff game later in the season, and they were recruiting him, and Sean Cody's dad came to the game. He saw Ed Orgeron and asked Ed, what are you doing here? He's not going to USC. And Ed was like, hey, we're going to keep on recruiting him and you're going to be an option for him. And it was one of those things that like, it looked like that much of a far gone conclusion. He was going to go to Notre Dame or maybe somewhere else. And it was just sort of the relentlessness of USC and Ed Orgeron and Pete Carroll and making sure that they stuck with him. They stuck with him. And then, you know, at the end of the season, were a better option than maybe, you know, the family and Sean Cody thought they were going to be. And so there's a lot of those sort of underlying stories. There's, You know, a lot of what made this piece difficult to write was there's a lot there that you kind of have to hold back. You know, there's certain specifics, and obviously the interest is in the details and the nuance of it and the interaction between certain people, but you also don't want to, you know, hang people out there to dry. And there's other things which could turn out to be sounding more like allegations than anything. I mean, obviously, the DeAnthony Thomas piece of going to Oregon and some of the things that we heard and with, you know, the Snoop Dogg Youth League and then Snoop Dogg's son going on up there with him on the official visit to Oregon, which is kind of random at that point. Cordell Brodus was not a big-time recruit at all. He was just a kid. He was a freshman going to the Diamond Bar. And he pops up, you know, on an official visit with DeAnthony Thomas. And there's a lot of connections there between the Snoop Dogg League and individuals who are still very active, you know, in Crenshaw Football Youth League and DeAnthony Thomas. And then obviously Snoop kind of wanted to have some type of apparel sponsorship and Nike. And there's a lot of people that threw some stuff out there, and you kind of have to hold back a little bit and say, you know what, this is not going to be a Yahoo, you know, investigative piece, excuse me, trying to get people in trouble. So it was one of those things. You kind of walked the line. A lot of these stories, the details, it was years ago, so it's vague. And you kind of, you know, I'm reaching out to, like, you know, coaches on the former staffs and talking to guys that I hadn't talked to in years about this kind of stuff and kind of going, hey, you know, with this particular guy, do you remember, like, wasn't it this, dad? Was it the basketball coach or the basketball AD that knew Adoree Jackson's dad and blah, blah, blah. And you're talking to people and, you know, you think, oh yeah, they remember this like it's yesterday. But then it turns out that I actually ended up remembering a lot more than those guys. And I'm trying to refresh their memories. Like, no, remember you told me that. No, that was it. And they don't remember, so they got to go back in your notes. I'm trying to pull up old stories from, like, my old computer and stuff. And the other thing is funny because we're not a scout, and I don't have a Rivals subscription anymore. I don't go to Rivals. I don't read Rivals. And so I don't have my old stories. I don't have the notes in those. You know, like I know there's certain things I want to mention. I was trying to think of the entire group of official visitors who visited for homecoming week against Washington State when Percy Harvin and LaShawn McCoy were in town. And I actually asked a few of the former coaches in that staff and had no clue. We'll rename nameless here, but one of the coaches was talking about Rashay Caldwell, and I was like, dude, you're like not even in the same year. Like, what are you talking about? He was not there that weekend. Like, don't you remember LaShawn McCoy? He had a cast on. He was in crutches. The funny thing about that also,
it's funny that you remember more than these guys, dude. That's just hilarious. That's why we're talking about Gerard knows his stuff. He remembers stuff that coaches tell him, and they don't even remember it to this day. That's hilarious.
Well, yeah, but obviously my job is to remember that stuff, so it probably sticks in a little more. It's their job to recruit the kids. And if they don't get the kids, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. It's on to the next, where, like, that was a story for us. And that weekend I remember specifically because they had a tailgate. It was Josh Pinkert's family that used to tailgate in the Coliseum. And it was like, I think that west end of the Coliseum, and we had the RV back then. And we actually ended up in the RV right next to them. And so they had all the kids come over, and they had Percy, and they had LaShawn McCoy, and they had all those guys. And obviously, you know, we're not in there. You kind of keep your distance or anything, but you could see the guys all over there kind of hanging out. And it was like, oh, wow. And I just remember this, like, this group of dudes. And that was a really crazy class just in general. And that was the other thing, that there's so many stories. Like, there's, you know, people are asking me about Jalen Ramsey, and there's so many different stories that you could go on. You could have 50 of them, you know. And with that, even that class, I mean, Michael Goodson. I mean, that was really one of the craziest stories, I think, in recruiting for me personally. And it didn't make it because I don't think it had as much impact as the Percy Harvin or maybe even LaShawn McCoy. Some of those guys that were, I think, higher up on the board, and probably if they would have come to USC – would have been a bigger deal. But the Michael Morgan, again, was probably a little more personal just because following that just gave me such a headache. The kid committed to USC over the summer, then went to Oklahoma State and committed. And he committed silently to USC on his unofficial visit, but then like a week later, 2 weeks later, he went to Oklahoma and Oklahoma State, and then he publicly committed to Oklahoma State. There were so many allegations. There was so much stuff about people saying he got paid off to go to Oklahoma State. There was a lot of those whispers going on. And again, that's just allegations. That's just a lot of gossip. So you don't want to necessarily write a story about that. But then he went through the summer, and then early in the process, probably the beginning of October, he's like, I'm going to take all five of my official visits. He went to a couple schools. A&M was one of those schools. He ended up coming and officially visiting USC. And the funny thing about that was, on his official visit to USC, his dad came out with him, and his dad met a lot of the parents of the other recruits. Alan Bradford happened to be on that weekend. I think it was the Notre Dame or UCLA weekend. It was whatever the last game of the season was for USC, and they brought in like six guys for that official visit weekend. And Michael Morgan's dad evidently was like trying to sell real estate property to people on the official visit. Like all the parents, he was like hitting them up for like, hey man, you want to invest in this, you know, timeshare thing going on in North Carolina of all places. And I remember Alan Bradford's dad telling me about it, going, this guy is shady. Like, he seemed really weird. Like, there's something really off about this guy. And lo and behold, fast forward to, you know, after signing day, we see Michael Goodson ends up committing to Texas A&M. His head coach ends up getting a job in the support staff. His dad, literally about a year later, gets put in jail for insurance fraud, and it's like 25 to life in like real penitentiary, like real prison. Whoa. And so it's like one of those things, like, oh my gosh, I remember him trying to sell this real estate to people on his official visit. He ended up getting thrown in prison for it. So I mean, crazy, crazy stuff, and a lot of stuff in between of that recruitment that, you know, you remember and stuff like that. But it's just a lot of, like, is this a personal story that I remember because I was, you know, covering it, and I was so up to my eyeballs and this nonsense, and this kid, you know, burned through, like, Michael Morgan probably burned through, like, 7 cell phone numbers during the recruiting process at that point.
Michael Goodson.
Or is this actually was impactful for USC, you know, as a program? And that, we try to go with that more. Like, these are the turning points. These are some key stories that helped or hurt USC, you know, in a big way. Manti Te'o, obviously, I think that hurt USC, you know, later on that last season for Pete Carroll, because they didn't get the linebackers that they wanted. You know, that was the class that they were supposed to sort of restock the linebacker position. You had Cushing and Kaluka and Luther Brown, and you had that amazing Ray Maluga, those amazing linebacker class, and obviously they all left, including Clay Matthews, who redshirted. And so it was like, okay, who's on the board? Well, you got Manti Te'o, you know, grew up a USC fan, love USC, from Hawaii, Polynesian connection. Boom, 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 you're going to get him. He'll wear number 55. This Fontez Burfict kid, maybe even better, might even be a better athlete. He's over Corona Centennial, Trojan fan. Okay, he's already committed over the summer. I mean, you just were sort of penciling in, like, okay, man, here's the next group, and then it completely fell apart on USC. So that sort of was a story in and of itself, but obviously the Manti Te'o story, probably one of the hardest for USC to swallow on signing day, when he tells everybody, you know, I'm going to go to Notre Dame, which made no sense, just, you know, just with the context of everything. Again, Notre Dame was terrible that season. They threw snowballs at the team coming off the field because they had lost to Syracuse the weekend of his official visit. He didn't even show up for the second half. It was so cold. He actually stayed in the locker room and played video games with the other recruits. So you're thinking to yourself, why? There's no way he's going to Notre Dame. But that's recruiting. Sometimes it's like the unexplainable happens.
Yeah, it's great. We actually had Sean Cody on the podcast a few weeks ago, a month ago or something like that. He's doing the pregame and postgame show. So if you want to call in and ask him about his recruitment, they love getting calls after the game. So he's on the local ESPN radio here. So if you're driving out of the Coliseum this weekend, give Sean a call. Tell him we heard about him on the Peristyle podcast about his recruitment. I brought it up on the podcast too, Gerard. I mean, that was really what the first big recruit for Pete Carroll and kind of got this thing rolling. There's always good stories, and USC's always been, you know, good at recruiting, but the Pete Carroll years, that's when it was just, you know, the heyday and the number one classes and all that stuff, and it really kind of started with Sean Cody.
Yeah. I mean, and Mike Morgan sort of, like, there's the epitome of how much they were rolling, how much momentum they have. I mean, they almost accidentally got a guy, you know, that was a four-star linebacker that at this point has played in the league for what, like 6 years, 7 years maybe here coming up? I mean, he's been in the league for a while. He's not a starter for Seattle, but he's played special teams and he's been in the second team rotation, you know, pretty much from the jump for Pete Carroll. So it's like, wow, when you can unexpectedly get a guy like that, you're doing pretty good in recruiting.
One other thing before we get into the questions, Gerard, in the second piece, you talked about the Rising Stars camp, and that certainly was something. It was great vision by Pete Carroll, and he created, I mean, it's kind of like it's probably why the opening is what it is right now, is from the Rising Stars camp. But maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the Rising Stars camp was sort of that first branded camp that any college had. You know, since then you've had Urban Meyer start the Friday Night Lights camp, which is, he started in Florida, and now he's doing Ohio State. And it's really just a camp where it's a national camp. You know, it's not just the local, hey, bring some guys in and maybe, you know, we'll get a occasional out of state recruit that's interested in USC. This was sort of, it was an event. You know, it was something that Pete Carroll, he wanted everybody to come to. He wanted the media to cover it. He wanted to make it big. And it was like sort of the opening before the opening. And we talk a little bit about the one guy that still stands out to this day as being probably the best overall athlete we ever saw at that camp. And it's saying a lot, because there's been a lot of really good players that have come and gone that attended Rising Stars. But Patrick Peterson, who at that time was Patrick Johnson, we'll talk a little bit about him and just watching him play. And just if you ever wanted to play football in a one-on-one format somehow, and you needed a guy to catch the ball, throw the ball, run the ball, tackle, do everything, it's like Patrick Peterson would be that guy. I mean, he, you know, at this point he's like 6'1", 220 or whatever. Then he was about 195, but he was the fastest, most explosive. He was strong. I mean, he could just do it all. And every drill you watched him, you're like, man, this guy is so fast, so big, so smooth. And then at the Rising Stars camp, they do this thing called Trojan Ball, which is basically, it's grab ass. It's just a bunch of guys running around and they throw the ball and I can't even explain it. It's sort of like, I don't even know how to say, I can't even say that the it's probably be politically incorrect to say the name of this, it's non-tackle smear the guy with the ball, and we'll just leave it at that. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, Ryan, but I don't want to say the word, because it might be categorized as hate speech and we'll get taken down off of iTunes or some crazy thing. But anyways, it's really just stupid little thing that they do, but they throw the ball around, they run around, jump and catch the ball, and it's called Trojan Ball. And we actually watched it with Patrick Johnson, and a lot of guys at the camps don't usually participate in that. Usually that's at the end of the camp and the star guys are just off the side and they're hanging out with the coaches or whatever. But Patrick Johnson was like legitimately into this. Like, he was trying to become like an All-American through Trojan Ball, and he was just jumping over people, like literally just jumping over people, catching the ball. He's throwing the ball like flat-footed 70 yards, just great. Like, you just get to see his athleticism, and we're watching this, and you don't ever watch Trojan Ball as a reporter. There's nothing to report on for it, you know. It's not really football, and it's just kind of like, it's, like I said, it's kind of grab ass. So you're sitting here watching it, and usually we just kind of look around and there's nobody really involved in it. It's like, okay, whatever, for the intramural kids that are, you know, paying to go to the camp. But Patrick Johnson, there he is, flying over people, scoring touchdowns in Trojan Ball. And it was just like, man, yeah, this is probably the best dude that's ever been to this camp. And even to this point, he probably is the best all-around athlete that we've ever seen at Rising Stars. So that was kind of an interesting thing. And that defense that USC had back in, I think it was like 2010 class, with, you know, all those guys like Ronald Powell and Jackson Jeffcoat and George Uko, Josh Shaw, Tony Jefferson, Deion Bailey. It was just this long list of guys. I mean, they literally had like two rotations on defense. And you just, I mean, right then and there, when you're watching, you're going, gosh, if they could just get all these guys, that's their defense for the next 4 years. I mean, all these guys. And, you know, the handful of those guys just in that camp on the first rotation of defense ended up playing in the NFL. They're still playing in the NFL. So those kind of things are pretty crazy when you see guys at that time and you can actually see it and make that call. That's when you know, wow, that was pretty special.
So make sure you check out the two pieces up on USCfootball.com. We got them pinned on the Peristyle. They're up on the front page. We've had a lot of content go up, so you might have to scroll down a little bit to get to them. But yeah, lots of good stuff from Gerard Martinez on this one. It's all part of our 20th year anniversary. Gerard hasn't been here the whole time, but for most of it, most of the great recruiting stories, Gerard. But it was nice that you could go back and talk to guys like Greg Biggins and stuff to get some of the older stories. Like, I think Poly 5 and stuff, that was like before your time at USCfootball.com.
Yeah, Sean Cody was before my time as an actual writer. I remember watching Sean Cody in high school. I actually went to the Texas Cal Shrine game and I saw him play in person. But yeah, some of these stories were, in terms of the nuance and the things happening behind the scenes, were definitely, yeah, before I was actually writing. So I reached out to guys like Greg Biggins, who've been, you know, in the business here a lot longer than me. Rick Kimbrell, I hit up, who, you know, probably 20, almost 30 years now, doing recruiting and writing, and obviously the coaches that were involved at that time trying to, you know, gather more intel from them. But like I said, the coaches have forgotten more than I thought they would. But a guy like Greg, you know, in the business as well and has to write about these guys, he remembers these things. Like, they hit you harder. They're of a bigger impact because our job is to follow those stories and to know all we can about those stories. Whereas the coaches, it's just sort of like in passing and, you know, oh yeah, I kind of remember that, but they've seen like 100,000 players since that point. So, you know, kind of understandable why, those names come and go.
Well, let's, jump into some questions, Gerard. We got John who wrote in. He said, do you think the growth of the 7-on-7 circuit has resulted in more receivers and defensive backs getting 4- and 5-star ratings compared to other positions? I think in shorts and a tank top, I could get a 3-star rating playing in these tournaments. It seems highly rated wide receivers and DBs are a dime a dozen now, but it doesn't mean they are great football players. The most dominant and possible to cover wide receiver I ever saw was Mike Williams. And wasn't he a 4-star coming out of high school? Thanks for your time, John.
Mike Williams was a 4-star out of high school. A lot of people pegged him to be a tight end, actually, and that was sort of where Florida was recruiting him and probably the main reason USC was able to steal him away from Florida there kind of at the last minute. I don't know that more are being rated in terms of, you know, Scout 300. You tend to have still an even amount of guys that, you know, there's a certain amount of linemen, a certain amount of receivers. There is something to be said, however, though, for the amount of exposure that the skilled positions have in comparison to the linemen. We don't get to see a lot of the linemen, and I've been encouraging several people behind the scenes just to start some lineman camps, do more lineman stuff. And obviously, they're a little shy because, you know, nobody wants to get hurt. And in a one-on-one with a lineman, we've seen more injuries than we have with all the skill players. You very rarely in 7-on-7 actually see any severe or injuries that would be bad enough to actually keep a player out for a number of weeks in 7-on-7 just in the skeleton drills. And we've seen some concussions and we've seen some guys run into each other. But really, all in all, very rarely do you see bad injuries, you know, knee injuries or ankle injuries or anything that is really bad. But with linemen, we've seen at camps and one-on-ones a handful of knee injuries and a handful of injuries. And I don't know what that is about because, you know, obviously there's more contact. I guess that would be the thing. The physical contact, even though you're not in pads, with a one-on-one with a lineman, you're going to have more physicality and perhaps just more stress on ligaments and bones and guys falling and things like that. There's more that can go wrong. But you would think it wouldn't be as much, but I think probably the ratio is much higher. So people are just hesitant to start a lot of off-season lineman camps, one-on-one camps. But, you know, it wouldn't have to necessarily be a lot of one-on-ones. I mean, I'd like to see a camp with linemen just necessarily running around, just being out there. So I think in terms of evaluations and the exposure of linemen, there definitely could be a lot more. It is not balanced in terms of skilled players versus linemen. But again, I think with the services and how they rank guys, I think there's sort of a quota. You know, there's so many linemen that they want to look at and they want to be able to rank. And the same thing with defensive backs and receivers. That's my hunch. I haven't looked and actually seen there being, you know, numbers wise, opposed to maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, how many skill players are rated as opposed to linemen to now. I mean, I don't have those numbers on me, but I think that they would probably still try to keep some type of balance in terms of the actual ratings. Really, the question is the evaluation and there, how much over critiquing is there of the skill positions as opposed to the linemen. I think that's probably a bigger deal. I think you see a lineman, he has huddle film out, the huddle film is good, he's going to get rated. Whereas receiver, quarterback, somebody that's a skill position can have that same film out there, he comes out in the 7-on tournament, you get to see him quite a few times, and he's going to either drop or go up in the ratings, not just based on that film, but based on what he's doing in 7-on-7. So you get to see guys that are listed at 6'2", 190 pounds, and then you go and see them, and they're more like 6 foot 5'11", 175 pounds. You go, okay, that puts a little more context into what he's doing on film and how good he's actually on film. Whereas linemen, that's really huge. That's really important. And we just don't get to see enough of those guys in person. So I think in terms of the actual evaluation, yes, there's definitely some issues there. I wish we could see linemen more during the offseason. But in terms of how many guys are actually being rated, I think the services are still trying to balance it out and still have their quotas of, okay, we want so many quarterbacks. And it doesn't mean that they always, those numbers are always reached, because obviously if there's just not, you know, 30 really good linemen to have in the top 100, then there's not going to be 30 good linemen. But I think they're always in the back of their heads when these guys get together. I think they want to achieve certain numbers, and so they're giving that many guys a look. It's just the differences between in person, you know, with the skill players, and probably more on film outside of, you know, the occasional camps with the linemen.
All right, good stuff there. John, he said, please compare the following players as recruits. They seem pretty comparable to me at the same stage of their career. So first he has a large senior running back with great receiving skills, Joe Mixon, and Najee Harris. These kids seem, athletic-wise, at least, very similar as seniors. So that's the first part. I'll let you answer that. Then he has another part, too.
Yeah, similar. I think Najee Harris is a little smoother. He's a little different of an athlete, a little more upright. Joe Mixon, coming out of high school, was pretty powerfully built even then. Was very quick, had a great spin move, was really good in the open field. I think Najee's a little more of a slasher. He's definitely a guy that, you know, if you can get him on that off tackle or just get him to put his foot in the ground and then get upfield, that's sort of where he's at his strength. Both guys were really good receivers coming out of high school, though. Najee's a very good receiver. Joe Mixon was one of the best receivers as a running back that I think I've ever seen. I mean, he was really good. Every time we saw him, and this is a perfect example, 7-on-7, you know, as a running back, you're not going to get a lot of looks with the crucial, important attributes that you put next to a running back's name. You know, the things of like balance and breaking tackles and toughness, and there's a lot of stuff that goes into being a running back that you don't see in a 7-on-7 tournament. But the one thing you can judge is how good of a receiver a running back is and how much of a threat will he be in the passing game. And Joe Mixon was fantastic. He was always really good, had incredible hands in the passing game. And so I think Najee shares that. He's not as good. I don't think he's as prolific as Joe Mixon was when he was coming out of high school, but he's definitely an above average receiver. And I think, you know, to interject, you know, somebody that's probably a little more USC-centric to USC fans would be Stephen Carr, and he's also a very, very good receiver. Excellent out of the backfield, runs really good routes, very aware on his routes. And so, I would say the comparison, there's a comparison there. They're a little different, really more in their running style, and I think how they hit the line of scrimmage when you're talking about Joe Mixon and you're talking about Najee Harris. But, yeah, there are some similarities. You know, both are taller running backs, and both are really good, and they're both very, very, very good receivers.
And then on the quarterback side, he wanted you to compare these guys like as sophomores or juniors in high school, JT Daniels, modern day, Matt Barkley, also modern day, and Matt Corral at quarterback. What, compare those guys.
Well, you know, JT and Matt Barkley, there's some comparison. Obviously, they're both pocket quarterbacks, both at modern day, both starting early, you know, as freshmen, and both being pretty successful early on. We'll kind of have to see how JT Daniels develops. You know, I mean, comparing them just as freshmen, yeah, there's similarities there, definitely. They both have above average arms. Certainly just the fact that they're able to be composed and play at that high level that early on is impressive. You know, JT Daniels is leading probably the best team in California, one of the best teams in the country in modern day right now. They just beat St. John Bosco last week. That's in and of itself is impressive. And Matt Barkley was sort of on that same level. Certainly when Matt Barkley was graduating, modern day was not as high up. I would say that, you know, when Matt Barkley graduated, and really for most of his career there, modern day had some good linemen, but they really lacked a lot of good athletes on the outside. He didn't have a ton of great athletes to throw to. Victor Blackwell was really his one and only target while he was there for the majority of time at modern day, whereas JT Daniels has a pretty good group of receivers and a pretty good group of skill players. But again, you know, we kind of just have to see how he progresses and develops. He may get much taller, you know, perhaps he becomes a little more mobile. I mean, there's a lot of room, obviously, to see how they both kind of graduate in that kind of finished product, comparing that as opposed to just freshmen. But right now, yeah, I mean, there's a lot. On paper, there's a lot of comparisons with those two guys. Matt Corral, different guy. Different just in terms of the athletic ability, the way he throws the ball, just different than both of those guys. I think there's less of a comparison there. He's a better athlete, I think, outside the pocket. His trajectory in terms of how he throws the ball, he's much more of a zip intermediate passing player. He throws the ball well across the middle of the field. He gets it down. He gets it to his receivers quickly. He's not as much of a long ball thrower, I think, as Daniels or Matt Barkley. Matt Barkley, really early in his career, man, he chucked it downfield a lot. He was really a really good down the field passer. And sort of, again, that's why I'm saying, you know, kind of seeing how these guys compare more as JT Daniels progresses through his high school career. Because Matt Barkley, I felt like sort of, I don't know if he lost a little bit on the ball, throwing it deep, but he just wasn't quite as impressive, I felt, in the pass that he threw, the spiral, sort of just the touch that he put on the ball deep. It seemed to sort of, he took a step back, and I don't know if that had to do with leg injuries and things or just confidence, maybe the offensive line he was, I don't know what it was, but I kind of felt like that's, and it was weird because it sort of happened even when he was at USC. I felt like early on in his career at USC, he was better at throwing the ball downfield than he was later on at USC. I felt like that senior year really stands out as a year where he was kind of chucking the ball downfield, and then a lot of times he was underthrowing his guys. And if it wasn't for Robert Woods and Marquise Lee, he would have a whole lot more interceptions next to his name. And so we kind of have to see how JT Daniels progresses and if he's able to keep the live arm. But in comparing him with Matt Corral, different kind of players, really. And Matt Corral, like I said, is really more of an intermediate passer. And it's not because he doesn't have a big arm. He can throw the ball deep, but I'm – in terms of strengths and what he likes to do, he likes to keep it low. He likes to keep it, you know, the trajectory low and keep it on his receivers harder and faster. And in terms of athletic ability, I think he's better than both Matt and JT Daniels in terms of getting outside the pocket and even sort of being a design runner to some extent. He's not an athlete's athlete. He's not a guy that's going to run around and, you know, keep the ball a bunch on read option, but he can do that occasionally. He is actually pretty fast when he gets into the open field.
All right, good stuff there, comparisons. Eric wrote in. First, he said, need more recruiting podcasts. So, yeah, we like doing them too, Eric, and I'm glad you enjoy them. But you can always go to uscfootball.com, go to the Peristyle, and Gerard's answering questions there every day. He loves doing that. I don't know if he loves doing it, but he does it.
I do like doing it. I do want people to be informed and get insight into have that constant discussion and know, I mean, you're subscribing to this website. I'm there for you. Like, we're there. We're there to answer questions. We're there to give you as much information as we possibly can and to make it worth your while, make it a good experience. So, I mean, I like that. I mean, that's my job. That's what I'm getting paid to do. It's not like, hey, you guys can post on this message board and talk to each other if you want while we write stories for you. that's not part of the experience.
It is not. Thanks for Eric for writing that. But he says, does SA have a chance to steal a big time recruit or recruits on National Signing Day? Thanks. Love the show. You guys do a great job.
Well, of course they have a chance. we talk about this all the time. I mean, they have a chance. The question is how good of a chance? And then it becomes, you know, well, who do they have a really good chance at getting? We're still at a point where we kind of have to get to this Washington game to see where USC really is at the end of the season, because it still has questions about Clay Helton. You know, they could still lose games where you're still going to have a huge uproar of fans saying that he should be fired. Notre Dame and UCLA, I mean, you lose both those games, you think USC fans are going to be, oh, okay, yeah, let's bring back Clay Helton for another year. No. And so you're going to have this uproar of, yeah, he's on the hot seat. And that uncertainty, and we always talk about that uncertainty kind of kills out-of-state recruiting. That's exactly what it's going to do. So, I mean, are they in it for some five-star guys, some big-star guys? Yeah. I mean, even a local guy like Joseph Lewis. USC is definitely in it for Joseph Lewis. Everybody's talking about, oh, he's going to go to Nebraska and blah, blah, blah. Listen, if USC has some momentum, there's going to be that point in time where he's going to ask himself, do I need to go to Lincoln, Nebraska to further my football career when I could stay here in Los Angeles near my family and go to USC and do it. Like, there's just going to be that fork in the road for him. And if USC paints themselves as a winning picture and there's some momentum there and they can beat, you know, a couple teams here at the stretch, you know, I don't know if they have to beat, you know, people say, well, what games do they have to win? Do they have to beat Washington to get Joseph Lewis? Do they have to beat UCLA? What's the magic win for them? I don't know that, but there's going to be potential if they can win those games, and there's some excitement about Clay Helton. And there's like, oh, you know what? He's got Sam Darnold now. They've turned it around. Now there's a possibility that they could end up being the team that everybody hoped that they would be at the beginning of the season. So there's always that. And until we kind of – that plays out and we kind of see what's going on, we don't know who they have potential for and who are the guys that they might be able to land. Now, granted, I could throw names out there. You know, Jay Tufele is still a big fish out there. That's sort of USC's on the outside looking in right now. I mean, he's looking at – I think Michigan – I've said Michigan from day one is going to be the school I think that's probably going to be the one that's going to be the hardest to get him away from outside of Utah. Obviously, Utah being the hometown favorite. But I think Michigan has really come on strong with him and have been strong really since last spring. But that's a guy that is going to take an official visit to USC. He's going to look at USC, probably the top defensive tackle on their board, you know, and he's a guy that should be official visit. So, you know, you get those guys in town and you have a good year. You have some momentum. You got some people excited about USC football again. Then yeah, they have potential to get some of those guys. So we're just gonna have to wait and see. You know, D'Angelo Gibbs will be on an official visit here in a couple weeks. He's a guy that, you know, is a 5-star guy, athlete out of Georgia. His sister actually played basketball at USC a year ago. She just graduated, so he's got some ties to USC. He's gonna take an official visit. He's a long shot at this point, but you know, again, it's about having some momentum, winning some games. Let's say they went out and Clay Helton hits the road in home visits. Tell you what, that's a good staff in home. Clay Helton is very good in home. They could definitely steal a few guys. So you just kind of have to wait and see. Right now, it's just a matter of you know, seeing what happens at that end of the season and seeing how much momentum they're able to have and that being able to kind of just be that sort of tipping point for some of those out-of-state recruits, a guy like Jamel Cook or one of those players that feel like they can come out here and you know, have that stage to get to the NFL.
Yeah, certainly. This year, more than just about any, it's going to be about how this team finishes on the field. So very important final stretch for USC, not just for the season, but for recruiting as well. James wrote in, he said, how is Clay Helton's reputation in the inner city schools and coaches on the 7-on-7 circuit? I've heard Jim Mora doesn't have the greatest reputation there.
I don't know about Jim Mora's reputation. I think for the past few years, a lot of people kind of are waiting for Jim Mora to leave UCLA. And that was back, you know, 3-4 years ago. It's odd. It's just, maybe it's just his NFL pedigree that people continue to talk about him leaving and talk about him leaving. I know he's had some conflict with some coaches, more at the high school level than 7-on-7. But I don't know that it's enough or has been a big issue. Certainly, I haven't happened across a whole lot of stories or coaches or anybody that's, you know, been completely disgruntled with UCLA because of Jim Mora. And certainly, I haven't with Clay Helton either. And I talked about this a little bit on the Peristyle a few weeks ago. Somebody asked a similar question. You know, I don't think anybody really knows Clay Helton. I don't think anybody has any issues with Clay Helton. But what type of relationship does he have with inner city coaches? He hasn't been a head coach at USC for many years. This is his first year. And as an assistant coach, I understand he's been there for 6 years, but he was recruiting the Bay Area first and foremost for Lane Kiffin. And then when Lane Kiffin got fired, he started recruiting quarterbacks specifically. And obviously as a position group, that's very limited in terms of the number of prospects that you're going to have contact with. So that limits the number of coaches and schools you're going to have contact with. So while he's been there for 6 years, he hasn't been in a prime area for recruiting like a T. Martin or an Ed Orgeron or somebody where you would say, yeah, people definitely have an opinion of him. He's recruited enough guys at top schools that there is an opinion about who he is as a person and who he is as a coach. I don't think anybody really knows who Clay Helton is on either account. He comes off as sincere. The people that do have communication with him And just this past year, in the off season, a lot of the kids that talked about him, meeting him in person, really liked him. I mean, I remember Wyatt Davis just gushing about Clay Helton, and he loved Clay Helton. He loved the way Clay Helton pitched his program, his vision. He was just really excited about Clay Helton. Now, you know, Wyatt Davis turned around and committed to Ohio State, and he's probably going to end up going to Ohio State. So what does that tell you? I don't know. But, I mean, I think just in terms of, like, there being a set opinion of how he is, no, I don't think anybody has that yet. And it's in terms of inner-city schools specifically, he just hasn't recruited there enough. I mean, this is literally his first year having contact with a lot of those kids, and this being his quote-unquote program, I think opinions are still developing.
All right. Good one there. Let's see. We'll go Matthew. Let's go to Matthew. He said, you and Gerard have stated multiple times that the defense is trying to get bigger. Last year's class shows that, and this year's class is looking the same. My question is how that affects possibly hiring a new coach. Personally, I like Clay, but if we had a choice to bring in Les Miles, I'd take that all day. Given Miles' SEC background, would the current roster and recruiting class be an impact in regards to him coming to USC? Thanks and fight on from Matthew.
That's an interesting question. I mean, specifically with Miles, because obviously every coach comes in and has their system. I mean, you could say Chip Kelly. Well, all we know of Chip Kelly is that he likes long, lean defensive linemen, a lot of tall guys. He recruited Eric Armstead away from USC and kind of built his defense around those type of guys, like a lot of 6'6", 6'7", guys that are in that 270, 280 pound range. Not a lot of 330 pounders. Obviously, with their offense and the tempo that they play, it's hard to play those type of guys. So it's really sort of long, lean athletes on the defensive line. With Les Miles, harder to say because Les Miles is an offensive coach. So all we know from him from a defensive standpoint is sort of the defensive coaches that he hired and the systems they ran. Now, they've run a 4-3 at LSU from, I don't know, back from when I remember. I don't even remember them running anything but that. Defensive linemen have always been really good. I mean, LSU, if there's two things that they've always recruited well at, that stand out to me are probably defensive linemen and running backs. Defensive backs have had a really good run kind of the past decade, but like traditionally in what they recruit, and I think it has a lot to do with the geography and sort of the demographics of what is available in the talent pool. And Louisiana, Texas, that sort of that area, that bayou area, a lot of defensive linemen and a lot of running backs. And so that's what they've stacked their program with. Would he come in, look at the current recruiting class and say, yes, this fits what I'm looking for? I mean, it's hard to say. I think he would probably want to go after some of the guys that he was recruiting at LSU, probably more defensive linemen, maybe replace some of those defensive linemen. I don't know what his evaluation would be of USC's class. You know, would he come in and see a guy like Hunter Echols and say, he's too light to play on the defensive line for me? I don't know. He had Travavius Mingo that played at LSU. Was it Bartavius Mingo? Bartavius Mingo, I think,
yeah,
was his
name.
Yeah,
I think that was his name.
He was a guy that USC was recruiting that Ken Norton really liked, but he was like 220 pounds. He's like 6'6", 220 pounds, and you're going, okay, he might be really good, but how is he going to, you know, put on the weight to be able to play defensive line? Well, he ended up being a guy that, you know, it was a first-round, second-round pick. He's with the I think, Cleveland still right now. He was fine. You know, they put the weight on him. So maybe, you know, that would work out. I don't know. It's really hard to sort of guess and project what Les Miles would, how he would evaluate the current defensive line class at USC. I think obviously, he would want a lot of defensive linemen. Perhaps he'd come in and say, hey, we need more running backs than this. We need another guy other than Stephen Carr. You know, we know that he didn't recruit very good quarterbacks at LSU. That would probably be the one thing that would freak USC fans out because they're still going to have to sign probably a quarterback here in 2017 with Max Brown already, you know, going to transfer, and they need another quarterback on that roster. And Les Miles, I mean, all his time at LSU, even as an offensive coach, just didn't recruit very many good quarterbacks. So it's just tough. It's tough, like I said. It's really trying to project how a coach would come in and evaluate the prospects that are committed to USC right now. The only thing that we can say for sure is that every team that I think Les Miles has been involved with in terms of the defense that they've run, they've run a 4-3 defense. And this particular class, as a past classes that USC's recruited here under Steve Sarkisian, are 3-4 base defenses. So they're recruiting interior defensive linemen. When you're talking about defensive linemen, you're talking about guys that are going to have their hands on the ground, and they're going to be playing inside the tackles for the most part. And then you're talking about linebackers, which are really two different positions. The hybrid position that is going to be sort of the defensive end linebacker position, Porter Gustin, Yushena Nwosu, and then your actual standard linebackers who are going to be inside linebackers. So that's different. And so you kind of look at it and go, okay, you're not recruiting really hybrid guys to be standing up anymore. Those guys are have the hand on the ground. And then you have to sort of make the assessment, are those guys existing on the current roster? You know, do they want to get bigger guys inside to play that three technique instead of having maybe guys that are going to develop more? I will say this, and I'm rambling too much with this question, but I think with this class, you're seeing a lot of patience in projecting certain players, which I don't mind. And I think that has a lot of SC fans are sort of anxious about that. But you look at guys like James Lynch, Jacob Lichtenstein. These are guys that are not finished products by the just at all, like not even close. These are guys that USC sees. They're in that 240, 250 pound range right now. I think James Lynch is bigger than that. He's about 270. But these are guys that are going to be in the 290, 300 pound range. That's what USC is recruiting for. These are not strong side defensive ends. So that's what USC is projecting. If a guy like Les Miles comes in, he wants to run a 4-3, all of a sudden now you're questioning, am I kicking those guys out to play strong side defensive end in a 5 technique, or am I still projecting these guys to put on the weight and put them inside as a 3 technique? And so that's different, and it's just different. 3 technique and a 4-3 has to be a guy that can pass rush. He's got to be your playmaker. He's got to get upfield in that one gap. These guys are different. These guys are more interior 3-4 defensive linemen that USC's recruiting. They're not guys that are going to be big-time pass rushers. At least on film, they don't show that. They show to be more body catchers, plug-in guys, and with the 3-4, you're going to do that more. USC's still running a one gap right now with Clancy Pendergast, but with that personnel where they are lined up, more of a, you know, 4 inside technique, shifting them around, I think that might be where USC would change a little bit and have to pivot with a guy like Les Miles or any coach that would come in and want to run a 4-3 as opposed to the 3-4 that they're running right now.
All right. Mark in La Quinta wants to know, he said, do you detect a change in the type of athlete, and this is kind of along the same lines, or change scholarship allocations for different positions now that Clay Helton's the head coach? You talked about defensive backs, but not a lot of other positions like maybe focusing on larger blocking-oriented tight ends or faster receivers, maybe fullbacks, offensive linemen that can pull or zone blockers, larger running backs or speed backs, fast defensive linemen or big space eaters. I know the staff needs to focus on pressing needs, but if Gerard has any insight, that would be great. Mark in La Quinta.
And that kind of piggybacks off that last question. There's some overlap there in terms of talking about the defensive line and getting more space eaters and getting guys that they project that can come in and play those interior spots and just having more bodies. I think this is if there's one thing in terms of allocation of scholarships and where they're going, linemen. I think Clay Helton wants to recruit linemen, and he is much more willing to pull the trigger on linemen than Steve Sarkisian, Lane Kiffin, and Pete Carroll combined. Those guys were definitely like using the strategy of, we don't want to over-recruit the lines. Specifically, we don't want to over-recruit the offensive line, because if one of those guards or one of those guys on the inside doesn't pan out, they're dead weight on the roster. They're just not going anywhere. Whereas if you over-recruit another position, let's say receiver, you can move those guys into being tight ends. Or you can move them over the defense to be a defensive back. If you recruit a safety and it doesn't work out, bulk him up, put him down the linebacker. You can always sort of move a guy or shift a guy over if he's not playing well at one position. Whereas offensive line, you really don't have anywhere else to go. You know, special teams maybe, long snapper or something. But you're not getting much value out of those guys. And with Clay Helton, I think he just feels like, we need to get bigger, we need to be more physical, and the only way we're going to do that is if we just have more flat-out bodies on the offensive and defensive lines. So in terms of the number of scholarships and the change at specific positions, I would definitely say that. I'd definitely say that they're throwing more at the offensive line, defensive line. And in terms of defensive linemen, I mean, we're talking 4-5 interior defensive linemen in this class. That's a lot. And people are looking at the guys that they've signed and the guys that are already committed and sort of mentioning some of those guys. You know, we already talked about James Lynch, Jacob Lichtenstein, Greg Rogers, 6'4", 285-pound defensive tackle from Las Vegas is out there. Jay Tufeli, we mentioned. There's a few guys. They want them all. And I think in order to get two or three of those really high-end type guys, you also have to have the mortar guys, going back to the brick-and-mortar analogy. You know, you have to have those guys that don't have the huge egos, that are the workman guys, that maybe they need a red shirt, they could come in and they develop, and over time, sort of a guy like Christian Rector. Christian Rector, I think, is sort of, I think he has a shot to be that success story of a guy that comes in, 250, 260-pound defensive end, and then comes in and develops, puts on the weight, ends up being about 285, 290, and is a very good player for USC, a guy that can contribute. I actually feel like he should be contributing more at this point. I'm surprised he hasn't played more. USC's using this 2-4-5, like, every down, and I'm not sure I'm on board with that. I don't get that. I mean, I understand that that Clancy Pendergast feels like, personnel-wise, he's deeper at the defensive backfield than he is on the defensive line. But I still see Josh Fallow is a tight end up in Sacramento. Get all these names mixed up. Josh Fatu, the JC transfer that came in from Long Beach City College, he's shown some flashes. You got a guy like Richter there, who's a good player, who's shown a lot of flashes in fall camp. You know, there's two guys there that, you know, you could maybe run more three-man fronts. I think a guy like Christian Rector could be sort of that story of, yeah, he's not an All-American, amazing. You know, I mean, he actually was an Army All-American, so maybe it's a bad example. But, I mean, he wasn't the sort of gem of that recruiting class. He sort of was like another guy amongst a few different guys that they got, you know, next to Rasheen Green or some of these other dudes that were like the big name players. And I think that's sort of what USC is trying to build right now. They want to get guys that are good, solid players, project. Maybe they're not the big playmakers. Maybe they're more body catchers. Maybe they're more gap defenders. But there's still guys that you can get in that rotation and you can still develop some depth. And you got to practice with those guys. If you want to develop this physical mentality, those guys, just through attrition, you got to go through some of those guys. You know, you can't just have, okay, we're just going to recruit five great guys and just have a five-man rotation that's going to be amazing. We're going to have three starters that are going to all be All-Americans, and then we're going to have two more backups that are going to be freshman All-Americans. Like, it just doesn't work that way. If you want to have some depth, you got to start somewhere, and you got to start getting some bodies. And so I kind of think that's where this class is going. So, again, in terms of allocation, it's gone towards the defensive lines and the offensive lines. Other positions, USC wants to get bigger at receiver. I think that's something they definitely try to stay above that 6-foot level. I think we're receivers. They don't want small guys because of run blocking. That goes actually back to Lane Kiffin. There was a lot of that kind of thinking going on. Steve Sarkisian, not that thinking, totally. I'm going to say opposite, but he did not have the same fear, I think, of small receivers not being able to run block. And I think with his offense, he wanted to run different routes and sort of have more misdirection in his offense, have his receivers out of the backfield catch the ball more and be better in open space. So smaller guys were better fit for that. But I think now we've transitioned sort of more back to the lane thinking, and they want guys that are 6'2", 6'1", that can run block. And so you're not going to see a ton of small receivers. We've talked already about the defensive backs, taller, lankier, safeties, bigger, stronger, more like Pete Carroll. Linebackers, got to be bigger. You got to be big outside linebacker to play on the line of scrimmage and go up against offensive tackle. So, yeah, it's bigger across the board.
We got a couple more, Gerard. We're already at the hour mark, but we can knock these couple out. People love the show, so we don't do recruiting podcasts as much, so we'll go a little bit longer. Ted Manhattan Beach. Now, Ted, this was way too long, so we're going to, like, edit this down a little bit. It's like many points and many paragraphs and all this stuff. So he wants to know, he said, well, first of all, really enjoy the podcast and the great information you provide to Trojan Nation. He said he's going to try to keep it brief, but he certainly did not. But he wants to know, there's two prospects, and he wants to know if they have strong interest in USC. But there hasn't been much talk about them, and wants to get your thoughts on these prospects. So it's Solomon, and he actually gives me the pronunciation, which is nice, Tuliaupupu, who's a four-star offensive linebacker, outside linebacker. And then Jalen Hall, the five-star wide receiver from Hawkins High School, who's actually a 2018 prospect.
Did he give you the pronunciation for Jalen Hall?
He did not, no. But Tuliaupupu, that was nice, you know.
It's actually, and I learned this because I went to one of his games, it's Solomon Nokiakua Stroud Tuliaupupu. So that's his full name. So that was an interesting one. That was a cut and paster for that article. But you know, you got to remember pronunciation.
Ten Manhattan Beach, you failed. You didn't put the whole name there. So you gave me pronunciation, but you didn't give me the whole name. So sorry, Ted.
Yes, and actually, the hyphen is incorrect on the roster for Max Preps. So I also learned that it's actually Nokiakua apostrophe Stroud. So it's not Stroud Tuliaupupu. It's Nokiakua apostrophe Stroud. So that's his middle name. So anyways, where does USC sit with both those guys? Tuliaupupu, USC fan, grew up liking USC, has a good relationship with USC coaches. I get the vibe that he has a better relationship with Scott White, the linebacker coach at UCLA. At the end of the day, it might not matter, though. UCLA, not really sure what's going on over there. A lot of questions, sort of coaches, and I don't know, everything right now in Westwood. And with USC, I think they recruit him hard enough. Johnny Nansen, I think definitely tied in there. Good relationship with Johnny Nansen. I think USC's got a really good shot at him. He'll be a guy that's regionally recruited pretty hard. He's getting some national offers, but at this point, again, offers mean so little. A lot of schools from out of state nowadays just throw offers at any guy that pops up on the radar, you know, and USC does the same. I mean, it's the same thing. Some kid in Florida, you know, just had some good huddle film and all of a sudden, oh, he had a good weekend in the Nike camp. Oh, he's got an offer from USC. You know, they're just trying to get their foot in the door with these kids out of state, and they know they're probably not going to commit right away. So they kind of throw that offer out there. But really, when it comes to nuts and bolts of it, I see him being more of a Pac-12 recruit and coming down to Washington, UCLA, probably USC. Maybe there'll be another school in the mix. But a good player, very raw, kind of has a reckless style to his game. Sort of just goes out there and just plays with his hair on fire. runs high, takes on blocks too high, doesn't have a lot of fundamentals in terms of dropping his hips. But he's very physical and he's very aggressive and he attacks. And he's got athleticism. So, I mean, he's got all the tools there to be a top player. Jalen Hall is the physical specimen. I mean, he's a guy that, there's not a lot of guys that can stand next to Jody Lewis and look like a better prospect, but he's actually one of those guys. You know, he's a little taller, lankier, longer arms. He's got really good speed. The thing about Jalen Hall, he's got to catch the ball better. You know, he's a receiver and he looks the part, but this is really as much of a 7-on evaluation as it is in season, just because we go back to that question about 7-on-7 and the ratings and skill players as opposed to offensive linemen. There's a little more, maybe an over analysis that goes on with 7-on because we see these guys literally every weekend. And the one thing I've seen with Jalen Hall is he's just inconsistent catching the ball. He's not a real natural receiver. Certainly not in comparison to Jody Lewis. Jody Lewis is just right now a better football player. And so a lot of people say, Jalen Hall, maybe the best player in that class. I would reserve judgment on that, having seen him play in person quite a few times. He's got to catch the ball better. As a receiver and a guy certainly that has that much talent, he's just got to become a more natural pass catcher and better in terms of the clutch catch, you know, making those big-time catches across the middle when it really counts. That's really what he's got to work on.
All right, we got one last one from our buddy Bear Secutor. He said, Gerard, I assert that Chris Peterson has recruited as well against USC as any school in the West and maybe any school except Alabama and Ohio State. As I look over the Washington roster, I see at least 10 guys who USC would have been happy to sign. Would you agree? From 2016, he talked about Byron Murphy and Isaiah Gilchrist. 2015, Benning Potoyoi, or I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, Henry Roberts, Austin Joyner, and Buda Baker. And in 2014, Elijah Qualls, Jermaine Kelly, Joe Mathis, and Daryl Stringfellow. Did I miss anyone? That's Bear Secutor.
Yes, you missed. First of all, the assertion is incorrect. Byron Murphy and Isaiah Gilchrist are actually the only guys that Chris Peterson actually has recruited for Washington. So that's a list of a lot of guys. Some of those guys actually Steve Sarkisian recruited. Joe Mathis was a Steve Sarkisian recruit. Elijah Quayles, Steve Sarkisian, Jermaine Kelly, Steve Sarkisian. Jermaine Kelly's actually transferred out of Washington, so he's not even there anymore. The same goes for the DeMario Stringfellow is actually the name of the receiver that used to go to Washington that was recruited by Steve Sarkisian but is now actually at Ole Miss. He's actually playing really well for Ole Miss. So that's a list of names of guys that Chris Peterson didn't recruit. Henry Roberts, Buda Baker, I think was in there. None of those guys, I don't think any of those guys were actually recruited by Chris Peterson. And a lot of those guys, you know, Henry Roberts, and Austin Joyner, those guys are, they're going to Washington from the jump. I mean, those are Washington guys. Those are guys from Seattle, and those kind of surrounding areas. So it makes it hard. I would say Byron Murphy's really the only guy on that list that Chris Peterson actually kind of really got away from USC. And in that case, you know, it was a transition of a coaching staff. They had fired Keith Hayward, which, you know, like I said, you know, when that was going on, I didn't think that was a good move for Clay Helton. And it's shown out to be very true. It has not been a good move for him. Keith Hayward actually had a really good relationship with Byron Murphy. I don't want to say they would have got Byron Murphy. I mean, you know, how can you make that call? But they would have been right there to get Byron Murphy if they would have kept Keith Hayward. But they changed, you know, staffs, brought in a defensive back coach way late in the process. Didn't really have anybody on the West Coast really recruiting really hard at the defensive back position. Even, you know, the support staff guys were really sort of more on the East Coast at that point. So Byron Murphy was just a guy that sort of just they lost in the shuffle and ended up going to Washington. And which I think surprised a lot of people. I think most projected he would probably stay at Arizona State. And that sort of, I think, surprised people at USC and maybe other schools that he actually went to Washington. USC had a chance at him if they would have kept Keith Hayward, but they didn't. And so they ended up sort of going through that transition. And right now are kind of struggling with defensive back recruiting. That's been an issue. It's been brought up a lot by the fans. I'm not, you know, breaking news here. They've lost a couple commitments in the defensive back. Thomas Graham, corner, out of Rancho Cucamonga. They lost Bubba Bolden, the safety, out of Las Vegas, Bishop Gorman. And they just lost the guy that was basically a silent commit for USC. I mean, I don't want to put that on him, but he was really a heavy lean towards USC for a long time. Jalen Johnson from Fresno, and he just committed to Utah. So, you know, there's still time to get Jalen Johnson. He's still going to take his official visit to USC. This commitment, I don't know, this commitment doesn't mean much. What we actually found out is that he has a shoulder injury that's going to keep him out the rest of the year. So that might have actually motivated him to commit early. But why he committed early and picked Utah over USC, you know, that's kind of interesting. And certainly, you know, USC is going to have to sort of evaluate their defensive back recruiting at the end of the year. It's not the end of the year. It's not signing day yet. So we don't really know what the class is going to look like. But thus far, they've taken a few on the chin. And in regards to the question, some false assertions there. So can Chris Peterson out-recruit USC, when USC's going through different coaches and losing? Sure he can. I don't think Chris Peterson is going to beat out USC for a bunch of guys if USC is winning football games. If USC's, you know, up there at the top of the Pac-12 and, you know, there's going to be some momentum there. Yeah, I don't think so. But, you know, the question with the actual history of it thus far right now, it's just sort of a false premise to be able to answer.
Gerard Martinez, nobody does it better when it comes to USC football recruiting. He remembers all kinds of stuff more than the coaches do, turns out. So follow him on Twitter at GMartLive. You can follow me on Twitter at Inside Troy. Thanks, Gerard, for coming on. Great show.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Right. That's Gerard Martinez. Make sure you check him out on USCfootball.com. Always great stuff. And I hope you guys enjoyed this latest edition of the Peristyle podcast. Our last one before USC takes on Oregon this weekend for homecoming. So hope you enjoyed the show and we will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Peristyle podcast presented by USCfootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. Don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.